As a start, let's have you each introduce yourselves. We can go oldest to youngest and tell name and when and where you were born.
Okay, my name is Alice, Dr. Alice Ruth Hopper, Dr. And I was born in Roanoke, Virginia. My parents were ministering in Callaway, Virginia. And so I was born in Virginia. And went to Korea very early on. I was about a year and a half when we went to Korea.
Well, I go by Barron, my middle name, and I'm Joseph Barron Hopper, and I'm a junior, the same name as my father. And I was born in Chungju, Korea, after my parents went there as missionaries probably about a year before I was born. But I was born in 1948 there, so that was my start.
And you were the first American child born in Korea after World War II.
After people came back after the war, I think I was maybe the first one born, is my understanding.
And I'm David Hershey Hopper. I would have been born in Korea, but I was born in Richmond, Virginia, after my folks evacuated when the Korean War started June 25th, and I was born September 14th, 1950, in Richmond, Virginia, which the women of the church had some homes and apartments there, and when my folks reached the West Coast, they had found an open apartment there, and I think my Longenecker grandparents were there, so they went there, and I was born, and we stayed in Richmond only that first year of my life, so I really have no tie to my hometown, birthplace town.
I am Margaret Lois Hopper Faircloth, and I was born in Chungju, Korea, after the Korean War in 1955. I was delivered by Paul Crane by flashlight and assisted by Janet Keller on a snowy January day. I think my mother fell on the way to the hospital.
That explains some things.
Well, the reason she fell was we had very thoughtfully salted the sidewalk, and it melted the snow and then refroze.
Hmm. So your parents were missionaries in Korea with the Southern Presbyterian Church, but you also came from two sets of grandparents who were Southern Presbyterian missionaries as well. Can one of you give some background on your maternal grandparents, the Longeneckers?
Go ahead.
Well, they were missionaries in Belgian Congo for about 30 years, I think. And, that was the short story.
Grandfather was from Pennsylvania, Dutch country, Hershey Longenecker, and Minnie Howhart Longenecker was from the Midwest, from
Missouri,
and they had gone to the Congo at a difficult time at the end of World War One, but they served there, and Mama was raised most of her childhood years in the Congo, they had to leave in about 1950 because of grandfather's diabetes. He must have started on insulin when he got to the States, which must have been a brand new deal at that time, but he couldn't go back to the Congo and receive that.
They're interesting, at least interesting to me, that they were, Hershey and Minnie were not Presbyterians by upbringing. They both grew up in Christian homes, but became committed Presbyterians and served with the PCUS mission in Congo.
Yeah, and there's a lot of the history on that recorded in Grandfather Longenecker's autobiography, Memories of Congo.
Maybe, Alice, could you give some background on your paternal grandparents, the Hoppers?
My grandmother was from Rock Hill, South Carolina. She was a Baron, Annis Baron. And I don't remember if she had a middle name or not. She must have been in the South. But anyway, Grandfather Hopper was from Kentucky, from Stanford, Kentucky. And it still amazes me that grandmother's parents would allow a young girl from a small southern town to go heaven knows where. I mean, Korea was the hermit kingdom, so nobody knew much about it. She would have had to cross the United States and then get on a ship and go all the way over to a foreign country that no one knew much about, and there was no way to communicate with except by ship mail. But they served in the south end of Korea in Mokpo, and grandfather went up to Pyongyang, which is now the capital of North Korea, and taught at the seminary there, the theological seminary there in North Korea. Grandmother was very instrumental in teaching English to a number of people. I know somebody now who is a friend of a man who was taught by my grandmother in Mokpo, and he became the editor of the Seoul newspaper and was very prominent, maybe still is, but probably is retired, in South Korea. So she homeschooled all of her kids, and she was amazing, and my grandfather was amazing as far as his theological ability and theological knowledge.
Let me just throw in a couple things on him. He was apparently a tremendous theologian. He wrote a commentary on Isaiah, which was ultimately translated into Korean and published in Korea. But he did teach at the seminary in Seoul, in Pyongyang, just a couple of semesters. And later, when the seminary had fled Daegu, he taught there. But one of the interesting little stories that I don't know is recorded anywhere on him. He did a lot of rural evangelism and went to some of the islands around the Korean archipelago there off of Mokpo. But somewhere when he was leaving a village, he stole the devil's post from outside the village. Now, they had little totem pole-like devil's posts outside the villages, and he stole one of them.
How did you learn this?
I remember grandmother telling me that, but I don't know the details on that at all. but it upset a lot of people, apparently.
Well, what would he do with it when he got it back?
I don't know. I don't know where it went, but
burned it.
The little spirit post he stole from.
Well, let me also tell one story that I heard many, many years later when I was in Knoxville, and I was in a minister's group that would meet every month or something. And one of the ministers said, "Oh, was I the son of the Hoppers?" And I said, "Well," he was talking about my grandparents. I said, "No, I'm his grandson." He said, "Well, when in World War II, he had been down in the, I think, in one of the Japanese islands, and they were holding."
It was in the South Pacific, wasn't it, maybe?
What?
I think he had said in the South Pacific area.
Okay, well, anyhow, he was in the chaplain's corps, and one chaplain stood up in the back of a truck to teach or preach to a large group of Korean prisoners of war there. And he said, well, is there anyone here that can translate for me? And one man came forward, and later he asked him, well, where'd you learn English? Well, he had learned it from grandmother Annis Baron. So I thought that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the Koreans were taken as slave laborers for these islands that the Japanese had captured, and so anyway, that's fascinating.
I didn't know grandfather because by the time I came along, he had a nervous breakdown, and I just sort of knew him as someone who followed my grandmother around. And she had always struck me as a little bit severe. I think I was a little afraid of her. But I remember one time, Charlotte and I were sitting, my cousin Charlotte and I were sitting on the back steps of the Montreat house. And grandmother came out and sat down with us and was talking with us. And she said, I wish you could have known your grandfather. He was a wonderful man. So fun, and he would make us laugh and sing and play games. And I've always just remembered that moment, both as a tender side of my grandmother and also as who my grandfather really was that I never got to know.
I think it was probably a major PTSD triggered depression that he had, that you would call it nowadays. It wasn't called a mental breakdown then, but just threw him into a severe, severe depression that he never really came out of. And that was partly the consequence of returning to Korea. And so many of his seminary students and pastor friends had been killed by the occupying Japanese in World War II. And then later, the communists mass slaughtered the Christian leadership. So,
Annis was Annie Estelle, or Annie. Sorry, I just looked it up. Not Annie. Annie Estelle Baron. Annis was her nickname.
Really?
I think another interesting thing about your Hopper grandparents is they, you know, Joseph was from Kentucky, rural Kentucky. Annis was from Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is, you know, now the Charlotte Metro, but was probably a pretty small town back then. But they met in New York City because they went to New York City to this White's Bible Institute to train for the mission field. And they met in New York City, which seems remarkable to me for two young Southerners. And I think, if I memory serves, Annis was on her way to hoping to go to Egypt with the United Presbyterian Church Mission in Egypt, which was a very large mission. She came from the ARP church, which had historic connection to the United Presbyterian Church. But they got married and ended up in Korea, which actually brings us well to our next thing of how your parents met. So two kids, one grew up in Congo, one grew up in Korea, how they met and ended up back in Korea.
They met in Montreat. Montreat was the conference center for the denomination. And missionary children typically went there because they didn't have parents to go home to during the summertime. And they were used as workers for the conference center. So my mother was there, and there was a home established, I think, by the women of the General Assembly It was called Collegiate Home, and it was for college students to stay where they could work for the community, work for the Montreat Conference Center, and stay there and have meals and all for free. But because the missionaries from different countries stayed there, they made friendships and so forth. Mama considered Daddy a friend, but she began to be suspicious when he drove quite a long distance from wherever it was he was to Blackstone, Virginia, where she was working as the director of Christian education in a small church. Daddy drove there when gas was rationed, and the purpose, ostensibly, of the trip was to tell her about Aunt Martia, his sister's wedding. And she found that very suspicious. And I don't know exactly how the proposal happened, but she was on her way to Congo, had already been given some lovely suitcases with her initials on them, which the initials were in gold. I remember seeing the suitcase. And she was most embarrassed then when it turned out she would be going to Korea with my father rather than going to Africa to teach French.
So you said they started in Korea in 1949, is that right?
No, 47.
No, not 47. 47 was when I was born.
Well, I was born in Korea in 48, so it was before 48.
Okay.
or early 48, maybe.
Very good.
It would be in their book, Daddy's Memoirs.
It must have been early 1948 or something like that. But in any case, then I was born, and before long, the Korean War started, see, in 1950, in June of 1950. So they were just there a couple of years, and then this war started. And so they were out.
I remember going into the hospital to see Baron, my little baby brother, and I remember walking in at the foot of Mama's bed and not being particularly interested in the baby, but being more interested in the new doll that they gave me that was lying on the bottom of Mama's feet. And so I was introduced to Baron, but he did not impress me very much.
Well, such is life.
I'm interested, actually, to that. That's a good story. What are, for each of you, some of your earliest memories of Korea?
Well, I had no memories before the war, and so Alice was the only one who would have had any
memories. Did you remember Japan?
Yeah. Did you remember Japan?
No.
That was some of my early... Well, before we... See, after the war, we came back to Korea in, what, 1953? Well, 53. We came back to Japan. We couldn't go back into Korea yet. And the war was... Well, it was still guerrilla warfare going on and things like that. So we were in Japan for, I think, about 6 months. And I can remember that, various things about it. I remember we had a Korean woman, I mean, a Japanese woman working for us.
Tomiko-san.
Yeah, Tomiko. And she would take me on the bus when she would go to buy vegetables and things like that for our family. Did you travel with her on the bus?
I don't remember. We used to ride on the train because we would memorize the stops. They would call out the stops, and I used to remember what they were, but they would call out the stops on the Japanese train. But I remember getting to Yokohama. We rode the ship over there, and Baron and David did not like the food, and so they lived on, if you can believe this, ketchup sandwiches crossing the ocean.
Okay.
And there was a lady named Mrs. Crabtree, and she had a birthday that was skipped because we crossed the international date line, and the ship's cooks were very upset about this woman missing her birthday, so they baked the largest cake I have ever seen to this day. They baked it in a wash tub. So here was this huge cake. I don't remember what it tasted like. I just remember the size.
So were there other missionaries in Japan as well for the time that you spent there?
There were some waiting to get into Korea. I ended up having an earache one night in my right ear, and it became so intense that Mama called the doctor, that Dr. David Seal, that was waiting to go into Korea, and he came across Tokyo in a taxi, and took me with him to the Seventh-day Adventist Hospital, where he lanced my ear. And I just went with him. Mama had to stay home with the two boys, and he lanced my ear. And thereafter, for a week or more, he would come every day and hold his watch up to my ear and ask if I could hear it. And then the next day he would hold it a little bit farther away and a little bit farther away. And I have never had problems with hearing in that ear, or either ear to my knowledge, but that always impressed me that he would come all the way across. It was in the wintertime and it was very cold, and he took care of me and I survived.
Huh. I can remember other missionaries there too. I can remember we would get on a military bus, I think it was, go to a military base for worship services on Sunday. So, and we would see some of the other missionaries, that I would know later in Korea there. So,
I don't remember Japan, but yeah, I know that several of the, I'll say kids that I grew up with in Korea were in Japan at the same time. The Lintons were there.
I remember playing with Dave Linton and getting all muddy out in the yard. And I remember, Debbie Krim.
Yeah.
Well, that family was there because I remember she had the same birthday that I did. So we celebrated those together. So anyhow.
Daddy hitchhiked rides back from Korea a couple of times to see us in Japan. And I recently learned from a cousin of mine that the planes that they would hitchhike rides on were CIA planes.
That's wild.
That took a run back and forth from Kunsan Air Base.
How did he figure that out?
To Japan. Well, a certain individual who has access to that kind of information told me that.
Mm-hmm. Inside information.
Dad and Aunt Margaret, do you have some early memories in Korea?
My first memory was from when I was about 3.5 years old, and we were leaving to come home on furlough, and it would have been my first time coming to the United States, and I'd been told about this but didn't really understand it. And I remember as we were leaving, they were loading up the car and stuff, and I was sitting on the swing on our big front porch with Pong Sunny, who was our kind of nanny, and crying because I was going to be leaving her. So that's a snapshot in my mind. And then I remember when we got to the States and we're staying in a house in Montreat, and I remember thinking Americans were really stupid because I had grown up in a bilingual home, and people in America just didn't understand this other language, and I just thought that was really ridiculous.
I forgot to say my first memories, if they're correct, my first memory is driving up to Chunju Station when we arrived there, and forsythia were blooming on the bank below our house, between our house and the Linton home, and that's my earliest memory.
And I remember moving in with two single ladies. We moved into the house with Miss, is that not right?
Remember it.
Well, it was Bill Green and Miss Fontaine were living in a house. And our house was occupied by the American military.
Oh, that may be.
What?
That probably is. I didn't remember that.
Well, so we were put in that house, and I just remember that, and then the famous thing happened where these were American military officers in our house, and Daddy kept trying to get them out, and they, for a while, they wouldn't leave, and so he sent in a team to go ahead and start remodeling the house with them in it, and they quickly left. And
he pulled down the ceiling.
Yeah. But so I dubbed one of them, well, there must have been a woman there too, one of the nurses. I dubbed her her name was Ms. Vanderplast or something. I dubbed her Ms. Vanderplaster because they pulled the plaster all down around them. Yeah.
Dad, you've had the opportunity to visit Chungju in more recent years, and it's changed a lot. But what was Chungju, which is on the southwest side of Korea, what was it like in the 1950s, post-Korean War?
Even though Korea is one of the most modern countries in the world now, it was very, very third world, post-war, extreme poverty when we were there. But Chungju was a city of, I think, 150,000 to 200,000 people at that time. But it was a small town in Asia. And it was all tucked in one valley. The missionaries had been, the early missionaries, which had come there in the 1890s, had not been allowed to live inside the walled city and had been given this hill across the river as a place that they could stay. And so that's where the mission work had been developed. And over the years, the land was protected by the missionaries. So it was the only nicely wooded mountain hillside there at the edge of the city. And the Koreans all wonder why the Americans got the best place. For us growing up, there were no tall structures. There's a big Catholic church across town. It had an old city gate, but it was inside the town at that point, down near the marketplace. That one city gate was still standing, but we lived on this hill on the outskirts of town, and the mission hospital was located adjacent to it. The hill had on it half dozen missionary homes built from the 1920s on, and we were in an old southern style two-story brick square home. Go in. Daddy's study was kind of a big room on the right. On the left was the living room. Behind that was the dining room, and back right was the kitchen. And stairs went straight up the middle. And upstairs you had four bedrooms. So it looked like an old brick home on the street of any good southern town, because all the missionaries were Southern Presbyterians, were mostly Southern Presbyterian, a little bit upper classy type people had gone into the mission. So that's what the house was like in the town, but it was safe. We were a fenced community and had a gatekeeper, but we could go places.
The hill we were on had run originally over into other hills, and they had cut the road through, which meant you could come to the end point of our station and look down into the crevice that was cut through the, I mean, there were steep sides on either side of the road. And it was in those places that the beggars would live. They would cut back into the dirt and make a cave. And I remember Baron and David coming back to a meal one time, and Baron was laughing because he had seen a beggar go off to work. The man came out of his cave, and he, instead of washing his hands and face before he went to work, he grabbed up some dirt and smushed his hands together and rubbed it on his clothes and his face and everything, and then picked up, instead of his briefcase, he picked up a number 10 can, which was a large can that the military had used that had a metal handle on it, a wire handle across the top, and then he went off to beg. And there were a lot of beggars, and there were a lot of people who lived under the bridge that went from our side of the river into the main part of the town. They lived under shacks of all kinds. Originally, they would live under cardboard roofs under the bridge. Eventually, they began to scavenge from the military and use the beer cans, flatten them out, and make them into corrugated roofs. So you would see beer can roofs. They were corrugated, and they went up and down just like corrugated metal does. But they had Pabst and Blue Ribbon and Budweiser and everything like that. Eventually, of course, they also had Coca-Cola. But every time there would be a flood, there would be loss of life, people sleeping under the bridge. And under the bridge was also where women did their washing, or in that river. I never could understand how clothes came out clean, because it didn't appear to be clean water to me. But they would take out their washing and put it on a rock and beat it with two sticks. I later learned one time when I was visiting Pong Suni, the woman that Margaret referred to as our babysitter, I was babysitting her, and their grandmother lived with them. And she was doing the ironing, which consisted of a flat rock that had been actually smoothed out somewhat. And they had a sort of a folded sheet, it looked like, that was in the rock. And then they put the clothes on top of that and beat it with two sticks. And there was a rhythm to it. And she let me practice until I got the rhythm right, of beating the clothes I doubt if I was very good, but they also had what was known as a sad, I don't know how you spell it, but I would spell it S-A-D, iron. It was a tiny little iron that they put charcoal in. And so it would be like, we would consider a kettle, except it was shaped like an iron. And you put the charcoal in the top, and then while it was hot, then you did the ironing to get the wrinkles out.
Hmm. Yeah, Margaret, you talked about speaking Korean, and how are you learning Korean as young children? Is it just from being around the Korean staff on the compound, and
yeah.
Was there any formal instruction?
No. And particularly from the people that helped us in our home. We had a cook and this Pong Suni who did wash and took care of the kids and did various things.
Learned by immersion.
Yeah.
What?
We were language immersion. That's, you know, immersion.
Oh, yeah.
That's how they recommend people learn languages.
I don't remember not being able to speak it. Although I think I must have learned some before the war when I was 1.5. And then I came back and I don't remember not being able to speak.
Pong Suni would carry us on her back, and then she would stand and talk to us as she looked out over the city. And I don't remember what she said, but she would repeat stuff over and over again. But when I first went, I was 1.5 when we got there. And because children are not afraid to make mistakes, they learn to use their language more quickly. So my mother would tell me what to tell the cook to make for lunch, and I would hear it in English, run through the swinging door into the kitchen, and tell it to her in Korean, get her answer, and come back and translate it back into English. And so the flexibility. But when we got to the States on evacuation, apparently I refused to perform for people. People that didn't speak Korean, I would not speak Korean too. You know, they would say, say something, say something. So it was always the habit of Daddy to get, and it was later too, to get us kids to sing Jesus Loves Me. So I remember one time in Quitman when I was in kindergarten, standing up on a chair in a group of some type of a meeting of men, standing up by Daddy at a luncheon and singing Jesus Loves Me.
What would have been a normal day for you as children? I mean, all of you ended up in boarding school later on, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but just around Chunju as, you know, up through fifth or sixth grade, whenever you'd go off to boarding school, what would a day have been like?
Well, I know David and I spent an awful lot of time outside in the yard and beyond.
We knew the hill like the back of our hands. We knew every tree.
Yeah.
What was in the tree? What nest was in the tree?
I can tell you where there were a lot of fruit trees in our yard, actually, that the missionaries must have planted 20, 30 years ago before. And I can tell you where each tree was of different and what fruit they had. I mean, there was quince tree and, you know, cherry tree and
pomegranate tree.
I don't remember a pomegranate tree.
Anyhow, it wasn't a big
no,
trunk
a little bush.
Tree, but anyhow,
did we get pomegranates off it? I don't remember.
But we spent lots of time out in the yard, Tim, and we'd play games there. The Korean children, some of the boys knew us, and they would come and play with us. I mean, I don't know, as Alice said, we were kind of a gated community, but everybody seemed to be able to come in whenever they wanted.
Were there other American children on the compound?
They were younger than Alice and me always.
Yeah.
Ginger Crane was the only one my age, mm-hmm. but there were some others younger they were, like say, around a half dozen homes, and some of the missionaries were long term. We were maybe the most one of the most consistent stay in Chunju the whole time family. Mm-hmm. The Cranes were there some of the time, and they had six kids. One passed away, but the oldest was my age. And they left for a time, then came back. The Seals came a little later, they had a son that was 3 years younger than me and a daughter that was Margaret's age, and another child. The Moores were there for a time, and David Moore was probably a couple years younger than me. Barron was the oldest boy around always, and Alice always the only oldest girl. You never had a peer on Chunju Station.
No.
Neither y'all did.
But then we, as far as the missionary community, there was one house that was dedicated to some of the nurses. They were all women, single women, and then another house had teachers who were women at the Bible school. And there was an older couple, the Lintons, right across the street from us, that they were like grandparents to us, kind of. And there was Bob Smith, who was a bachelor. And anyhow, so there would be various.
They didn't have a bachelor's house, but the places where the single women lived were referred to as the single ladies' houses. And, oh, that's a single lady's house. And that was how they were referred to. But I want to start with how our day started. It did not matter the age we were. It did not matter where we were. This would be on board ship. This would be on wherever, in the mountains, at home. We always started with morning prayers. And that meant Daddy would read from the Bible that he had. He read straight on through. One notable time was when he got his words twisted, and he was talking about Judas's last days, and he said, and the rope broke and his gowls bushed out. And of course,
his gowls,
yeah, he swapped the B and the G. And so I remember that, but we learned all verses of many, many hymns because Daddy played the piano, and when he wasn't there, Mama played the piano. And Mama would usually read to us from a Bible storybook. She usually read to us at night, but every morning we sang. And I remember wondering about that, wondering what the other people on the ship thought, when we would be singing, because our rooms where we stayed were right off, our cabins were right off the main lobby, and not everybody was a missionary that was going on the ship with us. And I remember Daddy taught us, Jesus, Savior, pilot me over life's tempestuous seas, when we were getting ready to go into a port. And he explained what the pilot did, and then later my mother took us up on the deck above the captain to watch us go into the harbor of Yokohama, and it was cold because we were at the front of the ship and it was blowing into our winds, and our feet were approximately level with that of the captain on the deck below. And Mama started us with this chant from Winnie the Pooh. The more it snows, tiddly-pum, the colder it grows, tiddly-pum. And our voices, of course, rose with each phrase until finally the captain turned around and glared at my mother and said, "Madam, can you keep those children quiet?" And we all silently filed down and went back into our cabin.
Well, back to the devotions. Daddy always prayed at the end of devotions. I don't think we all prayed. I think it was always Daddy. Mm-hmm. Daddy prayed, but yeah, morning devotions was a routine thing. We would have breakfast. I'm thinking in terms of when we're in Chunju. We'd have breakfast. Sometimes eggs, a lot of times cereal. The cereal was puffed rice primarily. You had this.
Two hot cereals.
Yeah, the ground wheat and millet.
Millet. Mm-hmm.
But the puffed rice was, the rice was taken downtown to this guy that pulled his cart around the town, would puff the rice for you. Now, y'all don't, Tim, you wouldn't remember, but back in the 60s and all the ads on TV for pop rice as blown from a gun. Well, this guy had a little round bomb-looking cylinder that would, the two halves would, or the door or something on it would bolt tight shut, and it was on a crank. He would crank it over a little charcoal. He put the rice in it, crank it over a little charcoal fire, had a screen, big screen basket at the end of the cart, and he had a pressure gauge on there. When the pressure got to a certain place, he would flip the handle that allowed the container to blow open, and it was like popcorn, a bowl full of popcorn all popping at once. It would go bang, blow out the puffed rice into this bag, and that's where our puffed rice cereal, you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never saw that. It just makes me sick.
The,
to think I never took advantage of that.
And anyway, so that's puff rice. We had puff rice, and we always had milk to eat on our cereal and our drink, because we were the only people who had a cow. We had had a dairy cow, one of two or three dairy cows in a city of almost a quarter of a million then, that Daddy had gotten somewhere.
And Daddy got our first service cow from the grandparents.
I thought the first cow survived the war, didn't
he? Yes. He was the grandparents' cow in Mokpo.
And the man we had working for us happened to know how to take care of a cow, so he got the cow.
And there was a barn.
So yeah, we had a barn.
We always had fresh milk. We'd pasteurize it by boiling it on the stove, and eventually they got a little pasteurizer container to put it in, and then you put it in the refrigerator, and the cream would rise to the top, and you scoop the cream off, and that's what made butter with, just shaking it back and forth in a quart jar sitting on the swing on the porch. And I never liked butter. Still don't like it.
Really? Interesting.
But we always had...
David doesn't like butter.
We have ice cream. We were the people who could fix good ice cream, because we had a crank churn
didn't fix it.
The man that worked for us would have a guy from the ice house downtown bring a big chunk of ice up on the back of his bicycle, and we crack it up with a hammer on the back steps.
But that one cow would always produce more milk, really, than we needed. And sometimes in our hospital there would be a baby born, and I don't know what would happen, but maybe the mother didn't get her milk or something.
Or died.
And so we would then provide milk for the baby. Or some of the other missionary families might have a similar situation. So the milk got around, you know.
We supplied milk, I think, to all of the houses on the American houses on the compound.
When we had abundance, yeah.
In those days, I don't think the Koreans drank much milk.
They didn't drink milk, but Mama would have a quart jar that was always sterilized that she could give milk. I don't know if we actually tithed it or what, but we would learn about babies in the village that were being starved because all they could drink was just the leftover rice water, which was when you cooked rice, there would be some left in the bottom, and you'd put water in it and boil it and stir it up, so it would be a very loose gruel that babies could be fed through a bottle, but it would not be very nourishing. So our milk was provided for women. They would come up and bring the bottle back, and it would be re-sterilized, and a fresh bottle of milk would be given to them. And so we didn't touch when it was in the refrigerator. It would be in a quart jar, and or mason jar, and so that would be for the ladies who would come to the back door and be given the milk.
Mama had a group of ladies up to the house one time, to the newer house later on, and after the ladies left, she had opened all the windows to air it out, because the Koreans had a kimchi smell to them, and somebody had forgotten her purse or something, came back up to the house to get it, and found Mama opening up and airing the place all out, and said, "Oh, you do that after we've been in your house. After you've been in our houses, we have to air it out, because Americans smell like milk."
Mm-hmm.
So that was our breakfast.
All that for breakfast.
Yeah, but we played, and Mama taught us school, and I don't know what you girls did all the time, but we played outdoors. Doris, Baron, and I had a fort.
You told us recently a story about finding bones. Can you tell about that?
Yeah, we had a fort that was an upside-down piano box at the top of a top of the bank, and we had dug a tunnel to get into it. And but we had kept various things in there. Remember having some human bones? You remember that?
In that fort? I don't remember in that fort.
You know the old pine tree just below the road, below the house, the gnarly pine tree that we'd sit up on?
Yeah.
Just below it, above the... Whose garden was that? That was somebody else's garden. There were some bones sticking out the bank there. And we dug up parts of human skeleton and took it up there and had it in our fort. I'm sure we were very sacrilege to the Koreans.
Well, they may not have known about it.
Well, I don't know.
I remember when the house that I can't remember who at first.
Fulton's house. They built it, you mean?
The one up the road from us, between us and
the
cranes. When they were excavating for that, yeah. We kids would go and sit on the bank above it and watch them dig. And we named different ones of the people that were working on the site. And I guess my mother must have been reading Treasure Island to us at the time, because when they dug up some human bones, which then slowed the project, they had to figure out what to do with them and regrave them and all like that. But we went home that lunch, and we had named the people the Barbary Pirates. And so we would sit there and we'd come home at lunch and tell about what they dug up today. And
Koreans buried people on the hillsides. They bury somebody and make a little mound of dirt over them. But this was post years of war, too. There have been various bodies just buried all over the place, too. But
they're an old culture. And they've been burying people for 2,000 years.
Like yeah, outside the city wall, there on the hillsides.
Well, there was a grave up behind our house that you could see from Mama's and Daddy's room. And you always knew it was a grave because here was this just rounded pile of dirt. And once or twice a year on different holidays, there would come the descendants of the buried person up there and offer a sacrifice, put out food and stuff like that for the spirits. And I think that is why I still have sort of a repulsion to putting flowers on graves. I remember Granddaddy Longenecker was talking about going to put some flowers on Grandmother's grave. When I was in college, I was washing the dishes, and I must have said something or made a noise or something. And because I thought of that as tantamount to idolatry. And he was horrified that I would have such an idea. But I'm sure that it's because of watching the person do the sacrifices to the big pile of dirt on the back of our hill.
Perrin, you remember we went over to watch the grave robbers?
Yeah, I remember that.
There would be these guys who would try and rob artifacts from old graves.
The main thing was they would stick an iron rod into the ground, and they would try to find porcelain or pottery jars that would have been left.
They could tell by the clunk when their iron rod.
They dig them up.
Hit it, and then they dig a hole down, and sometimes they bring up a broken one, or they'd broken it in the process, and they just toss it over the bank. And Baron and I would go back later and pick up the pieces to try and glue together a.
But these weren't necessarily old artifacts. They were.
Some of them probably were.
Well, maybe so.
Well, and then there was the little robber, the little grave robber. Didn't we call him that?
Yeah.
The man that sold things. He would come around and try to get the missionaries to buy different things. Isn't that where they got the Tiger Scroll?
I don't know that, but these extreme, some of them were extreme artifacts, little vases and wine cups and out of clay and all that probably were from a dynasty or two past, from 500 to 1,000 years old, some of them. And this guy would sit on the bottom steps out by the street by our house and try and sell these things.
Can I just jump in?
Sure. I was hoping we could uncover the mystery of what the young girls did all the time. We know what the boys did.
Well, I don't know what Alice did. But when Mama was teaching them school, I was with our nanny, Pong Suni. And, you know, she would take me around whatever she was doing, and I would be with her. I would be playing with other kids. I was a post-war baby. After the Korean War, I think every family had a baby. And there's a gap between me and David. So I'm a little bit younger than the other three and kind of grew up in a different cohort, different time. So I remember Mama homeschooling all of them. To me, it was not pretty, and I was never going to homeschool. I just saw it as being a very frustrating activity for her and for them.
We made it.
But you made it. But unlike them, I had kids my own age. I think almost every family had a baby that year. And so there were a lot of us, and I had other kids to play with. Now, I remember y'all always playing with the Korean kids. I didn't do that so much because I had missionary children to play with. And looking back, one of my regrets is that I didn't have more Korean friends, and I didn't learn the Korean language as well as they did because I didn't have the Korean friends. But I do remember your friends, and I remember being teased by them. My Korean name was Maguri, and they would call me Maguri Paguri, which means basket, and make me cry. So that's what I remember about your friends.
So we would, David and I would call you Maguri Paguri also, and we would, and make you mad. And we would call Alice, we would make up a name for her, Adishi Radishi. And get you upset and probably make you run to our parents.
Do you remember much about all those Korean boys that would come up to the yard and
there
play
were a
out
lot
various
of them.
Things?
There were a lot of them.
You remember the gateman there had three or four boys, and it was Ugani, Tegani, Chegani, and Hegani.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, I forgot that, yeah. I remember one of the boys had his leg amputated. I don't know what happened to him.
I don't remember the leg.
And he played with, he had crutches, and he could outrun us with his crutches.
Huh.
He just vault himself along. And a lot of them had got one meal a day. They were hungry.
We would play their games. Some of their games, and one of them was Motamoki, and you played it with nails.
I couldn't remember what that was called. I was trying to think.
Well, you would hold the nail with the point up between your finger and your thumb, and you would throw it down into the dirt, and it had to stand up. And it was kind of like marbles used to be played in America, where you would take the other person's marbles. You would win their marbles, and this damoki meant we're going to pick them off. We're going to take them from the other person. So you try to win all the nails.
You won it by kind of pinning on top of your nail, pinned on top of their nail.
Or knock their nail over. Anyhow, it was something that they had invented,
the
I guess.
Things.
But kids do that. So.
And the pechugi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was folded up pieces of paper into little squares that you'd throw down and flip the other person's over, and you'd win there.
We had an advantage because we had used magazines and stuff like that to make pechugi. We had an unlimited supply.
And we had
paper wasn't available for them.
Sometimes that we could pull from old cartons.
So we were well supplied with ammunition. So
girls used to play a game that would be similar to jump rope, except we didn't jump the rope. It was a thin, and I meant to bring some because I have some at home, but it was a thin black, about a little bit narrower than these cords here, of black rubber. And you would tie it around two girls' legs, one on each side, and then there was an intricate dance that kids would do, girls would do, twisting their legs back and forth and jumping across the, up and down across the cord, and there was, there would be various chants, I guess similar to what little girls did with jump ropes. And it was very intricate what you would do. And then there was another game.
Wasn't that Puddle Peedy, Peedy Peedy Tori?
Yeah.
Changal Tsega Nore Purundo.
Yeah.
Changnang Gatan Chevi.
Naya Hoya Chajokana. Yerata Chingu Chura. Sebuniata.
Chung Chung Da.
The song was about...
I haven't sung that for 70 years, but that's 65
that's
years.
That's a song about little birds that build outside your house. But that was one of the songs. And but it was amazing to watch the girls jump. And remember, they're wearing these rubber shoes that easily fall off, but they never fell off. And they would just jump over the... and be very precise, and I wish I had learned them well enough to be able to do them.
We would learn various tunes, though. One was a tune that was sung or played or something at a, there was an archery range in the valley in front of our house. It's the only one I ever remember seeing in Korea, but the archery target must have been about 10 feet tall and about 6 feet wide. And these little old men would stand in a little pavilion at one end of a long field, and at the other end would have the target, and the little old men would have beards and all, and they would fire their arrows down toward that.
Over 100 meters.
Yeah, it was a long way.
These were the old-timey
and that
bows and arrows.
That archery range is still there.
Is it?
It's a national treasure, actually, I think, and it's a great sport for them.
Well, they couldn't see where the arrow hit. It was so far they couldn't see where the arrow hit, and so there would be a little boy down there with flags, as I recall.
Fans.
A little fan that he would show where it hit. And. And there
Who
were several of those little boys got nailed over the years. And fortunately, it was about 200 yards up down below the hospital, and they got zipped up to the hospital.
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, these bows were made out of bone, I think.
Really?
I think I'm right on that. Or
they
senior.
Were totally recurved. When they were unstrung, they were backwards loop, and they would string them all the way up to here. And the pull on them was like a 100-pound pull or something that took great strength to be able to pull them.
Some of them had beards, and they had to be careful not to get that tangled.
Daddy had a picture of one man with a beard that he split it and put one over one side of his ear and one over the other side of his ear so it wouldn't get tangled in the bowstring.
When I was in Chunju last, which would have been about 8 years ago or something, I was in Seoul, took a bus down to Chunju for the day, and it was kind of depressing because I didn't know anybody. I wandered down to the archery range, and I sat there and watched archery and talked to the old men, and they gave me food to eat and things. It was interesting. It's still there.
I didn't know that.
Kind of like a bowling alley.
I mean, it's there with, over to the side, or a 15-story apartment buildings and things.
This is the song that they would sing at their big tournaments. Ki Hua Jia,
Ki Hua Jia, Ki Hua, Ki Hua, Ki Hua Jia, oh.
And it went on for this. So there are various songs that we knew. We knew the chant from when they would bring a funeral beer by. And
funerals were exciting. They would go through the pass that was down where the caves were that we spoke about earlier, and the non-Christian funerals were very colorful, and there were paper flowers of all colors all over the casket, and they would carry the casket on, much like we think about the Ark of the Covenant being carried on poles on people's shoulders. And they wore what was known as sackcloth, which was a burlap type of material that was sort of a yellowish, brownish color. And the men would have these tall hats that looked like upside down paper bags, and the women would wear braided straw rope in their hair, and everybody would wail and yell and cry, and of course at the non-Christian funerals they would be drunk, and some of them would be doing outlandish stuff, which was just wonderful for us to watch. So we would go and, oh, there's a funeral. So we would go, and maybe that's why I go to funerals. But we would go and watch them. Now, a Christian funeral was not as interesting because it was white. Everybody wore white, and they sang hymns. They didn't get drunk and act silly, so they weren't near as interesting.
And we called the men who wore the big sackcloth things on here, we called them sad sacks.
I think they would hire professional mourners, yes. Didn't they?
Yes.
So we heard Aunt Margaret's perspective on the homeschooling for the three older ones, but what was that like? And I guess, so what year, how old would you be when you went off to KCA? Sixth grade, seventh grade. Seventh grade. So what were those elementary school years like with?
It was boring for me.
I guess they'd bring in curriculum from the U.S. Yeah. of some kind.
Calvert.
We would get boxes in the fall, and it was very...
In the mail.
In the mail. They were from the Calvert Course, Tuscany Road in Baltimore, Maryland. And they had everything in them, from the pencils and the erasers to put on the pencils to a new ruler and a new box of crayons, the paper that you wrote on, and the books for that year.
And workbooks. And how much to use.
The curriculum, which was a manual that gave the daily lessons and so forth. There were times when Mama would, because I was the oldest, Mama would set the manual down in front of me and say, do what it says here, and then I'll go work with the boys. And she'd work with Baron David.
I just remember being bored and sitting at a little wooden table, looking out side windows of our house, and just watching the orioles play in the trees, and just this will never end. That's what I remember.
I remember sixth grade when Baron had gone off to boarding school, and we had school in the old Linton house down below us with. Mama was teaching me and John Seal. And John Seal was in third grade, and I was in sixth grade. And I persecuted him mercilessly.
Was that the year of the Christmas trees? Because I remember being down in that house when that happened.
Robert. No, the Christmas trees, I think, came the next year when I was in Tejon.
Okay.
That you prayed in the Christmas trees.
We must have still been in school in the same house.
I was so mad about that.
Because you weren't there?
Because I wasn't there.
Can somebody tell what happened?
I guess I was the only one who was there, and I was down in the Linton house in school. That Christmas, The Koreans had made a law that you couldn't chop down trees. Previously, Daddy would always take us out in the woods. We'd find a pine tree and take it home for a Christmas tree. It wasn't a Korean tradition at that time. So we would do that. But David had talked previously about the trees on the missionary compound. Most of the country was just denuded of trees, I think from the wartime. There just were not tall trees anywhere. And so they made a law that you couldn't cut down trees, and so we weren't going to be able to have a Christmas tree that year. And we were all very disappointed, no Christmas tree. So it was, I don't know, a week or two before Christmas, and I was in school, and Frankie Keller came running down. He was younger, wasn't in school yet, and said, there are Christmas trees falling in the Crane's yard. And so we all jumped up and ran up the hill to the Crane's house. The Cranes and Kellers shared a yard. There were two houses close to each other with a large yard there. And there was a military plane that was circling over the compound. And every time they would come around, they would push a Christmas tree out of their hatch. And they were bouncing in the yard. That's just what I remembered. I just have this mental picture of these trees just bouncing all over the Crane's yard. And the backstory was that we frequently made friends with the military guys. There was an air base and a missile base on either side of us. And some of the guys from the air base had been flying over to Japan for something, taking cargo to Japan, and we're going to be flying back with an empty plane. And so they filled it up with Christmas trees and brought them over. And I don't remember the exact story, but I think they were low on fuel or something and couldn't land. And so they just circled the compound and pushed out these trees and went back to their base and landed.
It was a helicopter, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
It was a helicopter. We actually learned the story because that would have been my last Christmas in Korea and before graduating and going to college. And one of the men that stayed with us that Christmas was a man whose job it was to test flares at the airport in Kunsan, because the Kunsan Air Force Base was a large base, and there wasn't communication. He had been trying to get communication, but there wasn't yet a walkie-talkie down for him to use that he could keep in touch with the tower. Mary Seal had gone to the air base at some point, and she had made known the fact that there were 8 families in Chunju that would not have a Christmas tree this year because of this new ruling. And so when I'm sorry?
The president was Park Chung-hee, and he was in control of everything.
When they shut down the cutting of trees. So these men, when they were at the Air Force Base in Japan, they saw some Christmas trees or something, and they had an empty Bombay on the plane that they were flying into Kunsan. So they stacked them in the Bombay. Out over the Sea of Japan, one of the lights indicating something was pressing on the hydraulic system started flashing, which meant they were supposed to empty whatever was in the Bombay, empty it into the Pacific. But they knew that their cargo was Christmas trees, so they did not want to empty that into the... So they alerted Kunsan that they were coming in on an emergency basis to prepare the base for them coming in. And meanwhile, at the other end of the airstrip, the man that was in our home for Christmas was getting ready to test flares. And a flare meant do not land. There's something going on the ground. Well, he didn't know what was going on with the tower, having this emergency plane coming in. And so they had foamed the runway and had emergency vehicles on standby, but he shot off a flare, which meant circle around and then come in again. And the tower was just livid because he had broken their protocol, but there was nothing for the pilot to do but circle around and then come in. So they landed amidst foam and everything like that because they didn't know what their landing gear would do. So then there was a problem of how to get the trees over to the children in the mission station. And they learned that there was a helicopter that was flying supplies down to Taegu to an orphanage down there. They were flying gifts down to orphans. So, well, could they put the trees in and just take them by Chunju on the way coming back? Oh, sure, fine. So they did that, but it turned out they were running low on fuel, and so they couldn't land and then get up again. They had to just circle around and assume somebody would see them and drop them. Hmm.
We had lots of relationships with the military, and they were helpful, and our parents were allowed to use the PX, and we could get groceries there that we couldn't get American-type food. We got that there. Our father and other missionaries would go to a little missile site that had about 150 men there, and one of the missionaries or another would go there and have a worship service on Sunday morning. So we would go with my father when he would do it, and we could get meet the young soldiers and all. And then one time they were going to throw away a bunch of out-of-date meat.
They had an inspection coming up and needed to clear their freezers before
the
inspection.
So they loaded up a little Jeep trailer, pretty much full, and covered it up and drove over to Chunju, and they brought it to our house. And so a station call went out to all the missionaries, you know, come and get it. And it was all this meat that was out of date, but I mean, we just all put it in our freezers and ate it. I mean, you know how
it was steaks and roaster chickens.
It was good
and,
meat.
And
so we had
good
all these
American
kinds of
meat. Yeah.
Relationships. My father would put them in touch with an orphanage. There was a leprosarium, and there was an orphanage. Well, the kids had to be taken away from their parents so they wouldn't get the disease. And I remember going out there to take the food, or to take the GIs there with their load of food to the orphanage. And they I'm sure that was meaningful to them. And I remember my father afterwards, oh, you know what the Koreans are going to do with all that good bacon? They're going to make soup out of it. We couldn't get bacon over there, so my father was just killed by that.
Let me tell two quick military-related things while we're talking about our relationship with the military. One was occasionally guys would fly a helicopter over, land on the boys' school playground at the bottom of the hill, and
disrupt our school thing
and come up to the station. But as soon as we heard a helicopter, we would, so much for school, we would zoom down to the there.
Right.
And one time, I don't know if it was just you and me.
No, I did too.
When we went up in the helicopter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we ran down.
We rode one time, yeah.
One time, and these guys said, would y'all like a ride?
And, no parental permission, just...
You know, no U.S. government permission, no parental permission. We climbed on board this old helicopter and they took us up and circled us over the station and if I remember right, the door was open with one of those rope things across it, and we could see down to Mama and Myeongseogyeom, and he were in the front yard, and you know, that was our first helicopter ride, only helicopter ride for me, but that was cool.
It was noisy.
And you know, nobody would allow that these days, but
Daddy apparently was in his office typing something. And he said, well, there goes the helicopter over overhead. I wouldn't be surprised if the kids aren't on board.
Oh, I didn't. And the other thing, the guys came over from the airbase one time. A group of guys came over, had supper with us, and I don't know if they'd brought hot dogs or anything, but anyway, somebody asked one of them if they'd say the blessing. And he said, God bless us in this godforsaken place.
Were y'all there when the military guys brought their helicopter up Chidi?
Yeah.
No.
You were there?
I was there.
One summer, there were some guys who were friends with, I don't know, maybe
probably
the Lintons.
Probably somebody from Gwangju, wasn't it?
They were from Gwangju. I don't know who they were friends with. But anyway, we were all up Chidi, our vacation place in the mountains. And they flew their helicopter up there and landed on the tennis court and stayed overnight one time. They did it a couple of times, I think.
Well, I just remember that the helicopter went straight away from our Chidi to go to Gwangju. It just went pew,
yeah,
like that.
I had forgotten all about that.
Really?
Thank you.